The vast majority of Americans are sad and embarrassed. And they're sad because they're embarrassed about what their country is becoming.
Coming up on In Contrast, George Will. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. George Will is a political commentator for The Washington Post, NBC News, and MSNBC. He's written over a dozen books on topics ranging from political philosophy to baseball. Will has received numerous awards for his writing and editorials, including a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. George Will, thank you for coming to In Contrast.
Glad to be with you.
Let me start with your giving up in 2016, being part of the Republican Party. Have you given up altogether on what the Republican Party is? Do you have any expectations in the midterm elections and in the 2020 of something that might attract you to bring you back?
First, let me say that giving up a political party is not like losing a leg. Samuel Johnson described himself as an unclubbable man, and I think I may be unclubbable. I like being a free agent. The Republican Party today approves of Donald Trump more strongly than they approved of Ronald Reagan at a similar point in his first term. As long as the party is protectionist and populist and radiates hostilities, it's not for me. But again, politics isn't the center of my universe anyway.
But if it is not for you, a thinking conservative, a man of ideas, and if people like you are leaving the party, then the rest of us who are not connected to the party but who believe that the other side should be strong in order for us to be strong should be worried as well.
Well, you should, because as the Republican Party gets smaller, it will get worse in the sense that the McCains and Senator Flake and Senator Corker and others who are leaving means that the ratio of Trump-type people to non-Trump-type people will go up. It's inexorable, and this will probably drive the party into a downward spiral, at least for a while.
And as the Republican Party becomes smaller, in the metaphor that you were using, and Trump becomes bigger, larger, more gargantuan in a number of ways, there are a sign of the last presidential election, a lot of particularly young people who are disenfranchised, disenchanted with what politics are about, and that do not feel either party as a portal or an entryway. And we've been through this in American history a number of times. Do you conceive of a future where the bipolar political reality that we have could become multipolar?
I don't think so. Third parties, it's been said, are like wasps. They sting and then die. The winner-take-all allocation of electoral votes by state, which is in every state except Nebraska and Maine, which does it by congressional district. The winner-take-all allocation of electoral votes means that if you're going to be competitive in presidential elections, and if you're not, you're not a serious party, you have to be one of the two parties. Remember, Ross Perot in 1992, at one point in June of that year, was ahead of the incumbent president, Bill Clinton. In the end, Ross Perot got more than 19% of the popular vote and zero electoral votes, because he had no regional base. Successful third parties have two things in common. One, the successful ones all fail, but they gain some electoral votes because they have a vivid personality, a regional base, and a burning issue. George Wallace in 1968 had all three, and that's the last time a third party won electoral votes.
Do you feel, though, that this bipolar reality that we have been with for all this time, and as parties mutate within themselves, is inevitable? Is there a chance to conceive of a future where, you know, we have seen two parties that have either splintered or have had subversions from within? We saw it with the Tea Party and the Republican Party. We're seeing it with the extreme left side of the Democratic Party. Is it conceivable, maybe in a utopian or dystopian world, that America doesn't have to be this way? Or are you saying that because of the personalities, because of the absence of base, this will always be the case? And maybe it's difficult to know so distant into the future.
I think our political parties are very sensitive market mechanisms. To change the metaphor a bit, they're like seismographs. They tremble at every little tremor from the electorate. They will adjust. When the public demands something, it will be supplied. The law of supply and demand works in the political market. So our parties will adjust rapidly. Now, we do have convulsive moments. I cast my first presidential vote, and I was first eligible to vote in 1964 for Barry Goldwater. Barry didn't like the way the Republican Party was configured, and he said, I'm going to change that. And he did. He was a reluctant candidate. He knew he wasn't going to win the presidency. But he said, it's worth running in order to change the trajectory of the party. And as I say, he did. So these convulsive moments can happen. A little inflection point in the history of both parties. I would expect that to happen this time around. Mr. Trump was and is an inflection point for the Republicans.
When giving up your connection with the party, on a number of occasions I have seen you describe yourself as moving in the direction of a libertarian. How do you define where you stand right now? And I have also heard you a number of times expressing, sometimes tangentially, this moment in your life of disappointment with politics or being fed up with this, as you just did earlier on. Where do you sit right now?
Well, I'm libertarian-ish. What we call conservatism in America, our labels are all confused. Someone with my or Barry Goldwater's or Milton Friedman's kind of belief is called in Europe a classic liberal, or in England a Manchester liberal, call you what you will. In America, we've decided that the progressives, which are really the way they ought to be called, the American liberal, believes in the state as an allocator of wealth and opportunity, and conservatives of my stripe, minimal government, natural rights conservatives, believe in the markets allocating wealth and opportunity. It's too late in the game to sort out the meaning of liberal and conservative to get it in conjunction with the tradition of Western political thought. But I am a conservative with a classic liberal bent. Now, when I say libertarian, I just mean before the government interferes with the freedom of the individual or the freedom of two or more individuals contracting together to do what they want, it ought to have a compelling reason. That's all. And it seems to me utter common sense.
And that compelling reason might be?
Depends. All I'm saying is that there's a burden on the government to justify what it's doing by saying, we know what we're doing is serious. We are making an excision from your sphere of personal autonomy and freedom. Here's our reason. I'm just asking the government to explain itself and justify itself.
As you look back at your long career as an opinion columnist, as a political thinker, and as a public intellectual, how would you succinctly describe the intellectual journey that you've had? From that very first vote that you described when you went to the polls to the George Will that will go to the polls in the midterm election or in 2020, how have you transformed?
Well, the world has transformed, and I've tried to keep up in the following sense. When I was an undergraduate, I graduated from Trinity College in Hartford in 1962. I was a Kennedy Democrat. But people forget that John Kennedy was a Cold Warrior. He criticized Nixon from the right on Cold War issues. I went to Oxford for 2 years, during which I went to see the freshly put up Berlin Wall. I watched what I thought was the creative energies of a great nation, Britain, being suffocated by the kind of watery socialism that they had, and still have, and came back and voted for Goldwater 4 years after supporting Kennedy. This was a very fertile time for conservative and classic liberal thinkers. Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom was published right then, as was Hayek's wonderful The Constitution of Liberty. There was a great ferment on the right, and I was part of that ferment. So once the Cold War goes away, then you think about other things.
I want to go back to the impact that Trump has had on all of us, on you and on the United States. I remember thinking, as an immigrant from Mexico, already seasoned here, that the second Bush, W. Bush, was, for some of us, frightening enough in his policies in Iraq, his use of language, to which I want to return to you in a few minutes, and thinking that it would be good to imagine a world where he was not there because nothing worse could be there. And now we have Donald Trump. And I wonder if we might have the same effect at some point, that we can't think of anything more ogre-like in the White House, but that in light of what might the future bring, Donald Trump could look tame.
No, I don't think so. I'm mildly amused that you would portray George W. Bush as pressing the bounds of the acceptable. He's certainly within the range of normal American politics. The current president, the 45th, is not. He's proudly discordant with almost every American political tradition, as far as I can see. One of the good effects of Mr. Trump is that he's going to cure a lot of people, including me, of what I would call presidential fastidiousness. Every 4 years, we go into the nominating process and say, well, Kasich's wrong about this, and Rubio's a little mistaken about that. Who cares from now on? They're all going to look good to me going forward.
Again, maybe being a little facetious here, but because I come from Latin America, I know the effect of tyrannical figures in Argentina, in Venezuela, in Chile. I'm thinking of Perón, Hugo Chavez, Pinochet, who after they either gave up power or died, the effect on national politics lingered for a long time, to the point that we would have the neo-Peronian approach to this or the Maduro approach to that in Venezuela. And Pinochet casts a shadow to this day, even though he left power in the late 80s. So as a foreigner, sometimes this country looks more and more Latin American to me, certainly in the way it handles its politics in certain corners, more so than others. And I wonder if that shadow, the shadow of this figure that we call Donald Trump, that is such an exception as you're describing it, might be actually harder to handle than the actual Donald Trump.
I don't think so. It depends, of course, on when and how the Trump presidency ends. The American people, I do not think, are angry. He thrives on anger and he stirs anger up. I think the vast majority of Americans are sad and embarrassed. And they're sad because they're embarrassed about what their country is becoming. That said, there are 327 million people in this country. At any given moment, more than 320 million of them are not watching cable television. They're not listening to talk radio. They're cleaning the gutters and washing the car and raising children and getting on with their lives. Politics just does not absorb Americans that way, and that's a sign of national health. It is an unhappy nation in which everyone is talking politics. Most Americans aren't. This is not a fragile country. It was not built by fragile people. Those people who set off from St. Joseph, Missouri to go to walk to Oregon and who carved homes out of the hillsides in Nebraska did not build a country that can be blown away by this or that passing demagogue.
In the topic of language, I want to go there for a minute with you. I'm always amazed when reading your columns at the quality of the sentence, the delicate, almost exquisite choice of words, and the clarity of thought. This at a time when the political debate seems muddled, and clarity and eloquence is not only not frequent, but rather an anomaly. At a time also where, as you said it to me not long ago, people are reading less and less, have you felt in your 40-plus year career that you have had to adapt your language to different audiences, or the audiences adapt to you?
They better, because I'm not going to adapt to them. No, I have the great advantage of scarcity of space. I have to deal with everything in 750 words. Now, that can be a lot if you pick your words right. And, as important, if you pick your syntax right so that you can pack nuance and intimation into a sentence, I rely on my readers to supply a lot, to bring a lot to the table, if you will. This is not television. Television is worse. Television is survival of the briefest. 30 seconds on television is a long time, hence the soundbite culture. But my feeling is that most Americans don't read newspapers. Most newspaper readers don't read the op-ed page. That's a good thing in this sense. The people who do read, pick up the paper, and do turn to the op-ed page are intellectually upscale. They are interested in politics. They read history books. They talk to one another, and therefore they're conversant with what I'm talking about. So I don't need to draw them a picture. I can assume a large base of knowledge.
And do you have already in your mind a target reader of a certain age, as educated as it is, or age does not matter?
I'm afraid my audience is aging as I am. I know no one under 30 who reads the hard copy of a newspaper, and I'm not sure they're reading digitally either.
The famous saying, I don't know what I think until I see what I say, when you put together a column and you do it twice a week, do your ideas coalesce before the first word has already been stamped on the screen or on the page? Or you figure out, knowing the boundaries of what your thought is, how that argument is going to be shaped, and even what the punch of that argument will be, only when it is already manifested.
The punch comes in the writing. That is, the writing takes me in places I didn't anticipate going. frankly, this will sound weird, but I'm probably not doing it right if I don't burst out laughing halfway through a column, if I haven't written a sentence that makes me laugh. There's nothing in the world more optional than reading a syndicated column. Therefore, it had better be fun or people aren't going to do it. If it's going to be fun, it ought to be well-written, and it ought to contain some stylistic flair, and it ought to have a really good lead sentence.
One of the qualities of your writing that I appreciate the most is that whereas other columnists can dispense adjectives in a rather loose way, you are careful in where those adjectives sit, and they are more powerful for that in an appreciation of a certain book or a certain move by this or that figure. The role of adjectives.
Well, they're modifiers. That's what they do, is they modify the noun, and they can make the noun sparkle or say things that it didn't have any intention of saying, just sitting there on the page. You mentioned a moment ago, and you rightly said, I'm in the opinion business, but I like to think that there's a whole lot of information in my columns, facts, data, numbers, etc. One of the nicest compliments I've ever received, I'll tell you two compliments. One, when I first started, I was the Washington editor of National Review, Bill Buckley's magazine, which was edited and run really by his sister Priscilla. And about 2 years into this, she said, and I just love this, she said, I would not need to see your byline in order to know which copy was yours, because I had a style. I've been a great admirer of people with particular styles. Murray Kempton, no one remembers Murray anymore. He was a wonderful columnist in New York. When I came east to go to school from Central Illinois in 1958, went down to New York, plopped down a nickel, which is what the New York Post cost in those days, opened it up and read a column by Murray Kempton, and I think I'm a columnist today because of that nickel. He was having so much fun and was so elegant. The second nicest compliment I got relatively recently was someone at the Washington Post Writers Group that edits and distributes the column, is the fact checker. And this person said to me, said, I had no idea how many facts were in your column until I had to check them all. So I considered that mission accomplished.
There has to be a difference between writing as a conservative for a newspaper like the Washington Post or the New York Times and writing as a conservative for a conservative newspaper.
No. I do not work for the Washington Post. They work for me. They distribute my column, and I pay them to do that. I've been in the paper for 40-some years, but I'm not a Washington Post employee. I've only been in their new building twice, maybe. I have 450 newspapers, and they range from the very liberal to the very conservative, and I don't think about any of them. I write to please me, frankly. That sounds terrible, but I want to say something clearly, and I want to say it well and let the chips fall where they may.
Can you give me an assessment of the current state of the opinion page in America? And I say this because all of us are aware of something that you were referring to, the polarized version of how the news are delivered to us. It used to be there was a centralized voice, that voice would be Walter Cronkite or the three main newscasters. And for better or worse, again, you had that set of information that was delivered and you made what you did with it. But now we have CNN on one side and Fox on the other side and a balkanization of the news landscape. So in the opinion pieces, it seems to me that those, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the 400 different syndicated newspapers, would you say that the new generation that is coming of op-ed writers is following in the path and cognizant of the history? Is there a break? Is it following this polarization?
I don't want to sound like a codger saying, oh, kids these days, but I think the opinion journalists are too heavy on opinion, too much participating in the shock value, the clickbait culture that they want to get attention. I mean, there's a cornucopia of information and opinion pieces flowing out of the internet every day. That's a good thing, and that more choice is a good thing. It's a bad thing in that it's a temptation to raise your voice and be more histrionic in order to get attention. In 1980, the year before CNN started, at the dinner hour in the United States, 80% of all the television sets in use were tuned to ABC, NBC, and CBS. Mm-hmm. Now, that oligopoly is long gone. And it's not really long gone because MSNBC and CNN and Fox have come along. They have tiny audiences. And the biggest audience on Fox is, what, maybe 3 million people in the evening? It's trivial. There was a time in this country in the 1950s when I Love Lucy had 70% of the country. They had 70 million people watching it. or MASH or Cheers or Seinfeld. There's been a fragmentation across the board. And on balance, I think that's a good thing.
You don't think that that fragmentation has the danger of fracturing us also in the way our attention can coalesce around certain thoughts, around certain icons?
A little bit. It does encourage and make possible confirmation bias. That is, people living in their intellectual silos, defining journalism and getting it on their own time in what they find congenial, only wanting that journalism that buttresses their preconceptions and their biases. That's a human attribute of all times and places, but a human attribute that is probably exacerbated by this cafeteria of choices we now have.
I want to move to a couple of topics. One of them is the topic of education, higher education. And I want to explore with you some of the big questions that the elite universities are facing these days. And in particular, I want to ask you about the absence of conservative voices within the faculty, in the debates. This is something that is not new, but it has become exacerbated in recent times, not only within the faculty, but even inviting people in that can generate discomfort because the students don't want to hear something that they don't want to hear. So the question to me is not, is this a fact? Being a professor myself, I can attest to that. The question is what to do about it. If diversity, for better or worse, has opened up in higher education when it comes to gender and race and class, what do we do in order for diversity also to take place at the level of ideology?
That's a difficult question because you really don't want people hired because of their political views. On the other hand, you don't want them not hired because of their political views. We know what happened. A generation of 1960s radicals went to Earth on the campus, got tenure, and now they're reproducing themselves. This is not complicated. And a lot of conservatives say, well, what the heck, good, we'll go into investment banking. You get the sociology department, I'll get rich. We can probably live with that. But I think the real problem isn't just the faculty, it's the students. And the problem with the students isn't the students, it's their parents. There has been a way of parenting in the middle classes and upper middle classes, the comprehensive helicopter parenting, the constant hovering, the protecting of children from spontaneity, from settling their own disputes, from free play. There's a whole movement in this country now called free-range parenting. Growing up the way I did, got up in the morning in the summer, I'd say goodbye to my parents, go out and ride my bike for 10 hours and come home. We didn't know it was free-range parenting. That was just being a kid. These cosseted children, their feelings protected and their emotional life fine-tuned by their parents, they get to college and they can't tolerate what colleges are supposed to be for, which is to make you uncomfortable, to make you run up against ideas that have sharp edges that are not congenial.
So you describe the generation of the 60s, the hippies that entered and reproduced itself. It is likely that this generation of parents, the helicopter parents that you are describing, who have coddled and protected the kids, will have the same effect, will create kids that themselves would do the same. What is this the result of? Why have we turned childhood into such a protected, failure-averse age? And is this an expression of the kind of isolation that the middle classes and the upper classes have of venturing with your bicycle into a part of the neighborhood that might not be as pleasant an area and a safe space as the parents would want?
Well, it's partly an intensified version of a common, indeed healthy phenomenon, which is parents wanting to pass on family advantages. We don't want to discourage that.
Right.
That's part of it. It also is, however, the fact that I think there's an aspirational part of this, that people are always looking at the coming college application process and the ferocious competition to acquire for your children the momentum for success that can come from the credentialing of a particular university. It's all of that. But I would love to know when and quite why parent became a verb. It used to be a noun. Now we say two parent. And I think when that became a verb, it was because we're saying parenting is a comprehensive activity. Better get back to where you opened the back door and said, come back for lunch.
And you did not parent like that, or your kids don't parent like that?
I don't think they do, no. It is, again, accepting the verb. It's commonly said we parent as we were parented, and my children weren't raised that way.
I want to move to the topic of baseball, where I know you are a great fan and a historian of the game as well, a Cubs fan, Chicago Cubs. I want to ask you two or three questions on this area. The game itself is fighting to remain pertinent to a young generation. The games are too many. They might be too long. There have been new rules implemented in order to make them shorter and to get audiences. With the exception of a few ball stadiums, the audience is low. Are we running the risk of turning the nation's pastime into a small group's pastime, or making it irrelevant at a time when attention span is such? There are other competing sports like soccer that are taking over and that connect the country to the rest of the world. Where does it stand today vis-a-vis the fertile grounds that you grew up with?
Well, I think baseball is like the country in that it's a huge success with some problems. That describes America at any given time. You mentioned the attendance. Actually, attendance is down very little this year, and it's almost entirely because appalling cold weather in April and early May, and B, they finally got the Miami Marlins to be honest about how they count their ticket sales. That's a little inside baseball, if you will, but that's the truth. It's not that the games are too long. People don't mind a three-hour game if there's 3 hours worth of action. And there's a style of play that is developed called all-or-nothing baseball. You either walk, strike out, or hit a home run, and that's not as interesting as it should be. But I'm telling you, markets work, and they're going to go into all these shifts, and the shifts will reward. They will create a demand for a different kind of hitter, and the market will supply that demand. So it'll self-correct in many ways, I think. And let's not lose sight of the fact that football has huge and insoluble problems. It turns out the human body is not made for the kinetic energy of football. The brain is floating in the brain pan, and football is bad for it. And middle-class parents particularly, but eventually all parents, are just not going to let their children play football.
But there's a big drive, on the other hand, by soccer, which is a very entertaining game, without interruptions, truly international or global, puts the idea of the World Series to shame in that it is Canada and the United States.
Yes, well,
and one could say the middle class and the upper middle class are embracing soccer much more than any other sport, maybe.
Well, you know, it used to be said Brazil is the nation of the future and always will be. Soccer is the sport of the future and always will be. I'm not. No, you're speaking like a good Mexican. But the fact is that soccer has been played by kids growing up now for several generations, and it still has not taken off. It might, and bless it, glad to have it do so. I must tell you, though, what we've learned about brain injuries is that the cumulative effect of small, unnoticed traumas to the brain have the effect of large concussions over time. And you're going to find, I think, sooner or later, more sooner than later, that heading a soccer ball is a problem. Probably not insoluble the way it is in football, but I would suspect that in 10 years, soccer players are going to be wearing some kind of head protection.
Yep. Baseball is incredibly individualistic, and I know that word is an important one. Everybody gets a chance and gets a second chance, and there's a rotation. So I wonder, baseball being a kind of window or mosaic through which to understand America as well, you know, the back and forth, if the issues of integration and the arrival of different immigrant groups, ethnic and racial, from Asia, from the Caribbean, from Latin America, the way they have entered. I just reread a beautiful review that you wrote about the Roberto Clemente biography by Marinus. Is in and of itself a lesson or a springboard through which to understand what could happen to America in terms of the melting pot?
Baseball absorbed immigrants because it's a ruthless meritocracy. You play 162 games, used to be 154. At the end of the season, you are your record. And during the season, if you can hit the ball, they don't care where you're from. The first wave of this was Joe DiMaggio, was meant so much to Italian Americans, Hank Greenberg to Jewish Americans, Roberto Clemente to Puerto Ricans and others. And that's still the case. This year on opening day, probably 27% of all the players on the opening day rosters were from outside North America. Korea, Japan, Taiwan, all over the place. And it will continue to be that way.
Do you think that will go also for the higher echelons of ownership and management?
Of course. Derek Jeter is a prominent African-American shortstop now running the Marlins. Baseball is, as I say, a meritocracy.
Coming to an end of this, do you like also baseball because it's a strategic and very intellectual game?
There's more good writing about baseball than all the other sports combined. I've published 15 books,
right.
One of which has sold probably more than the other 14 combined.
And it's about baseball.
It's called Men at Work, and it's now the best-selling baseball book ever. People like to read about it. It's a game of episodes rather than flow, like soccer. Strike one, strike two, one inning, two innings. So there's time between episodes to converse and to think and compare. It's also the case that baseball is one of America's oldest institutions, running way back deep into the 19th century. And Wrigley Field is older than Hoover Dam, Golden Gate Bridge, Lincoln Memorial. Same is true with Fenway Park. And there's only been one real disjunction in baseball history, dead ball era, lively ball era. So intergenerational comparisons are possible and meaningful, which is why statistics matter so much in baseball. There's a reason why it holds our attention. It also is the case, I must say, that it's the right sport for a democracy because there's so much failure in it. When Ted Williams hit 406, it meant that most of his at-bats, he did not get a hit. If you succeed 1 in 3 times, you're a 300 hitter and you're a superstar. Every team going to spring training knows it's going to win 60 games and knows it's going to lose 60 games, and you play the whole season to sort out the middle 42. There's a lot of losing in baseball. It's the sport of the half loaf. No one gets everything they want in democracy either.
Just develop a little bit more for me as we come here to the end. Failure and democracy. Is failure essential for democracy? I'm thinking here also of the other topic that we've discussed, and that is education. Failure is essential within the educational system in order to get our students to taste everything. So
failure is part of a system based on persuasion. That's what democracy is. You argue, you speak, you persuade. Not everybody's going to be persuaded. Not everyone is persuadable. Not everyone is persuasive. So you muddle along. Democracy is a nonstop perennial muddle. And yeah, it beats all the alternatives.
Is the role of sports too big in America today in
no,
general?
I like sports as the contemplation of excellence. That's what it is.
It's been a delight to have you in Contrast. Thank you for coming.
Glad to be with you.
News come to us online incessantly and instantaneously. Who can wait for a newspaper to deliver them? No wonder printed editions are in decline. There's also the fact that people read more in general, but mostly in bits and pieces. Reading the newspaper requires attention, and that's one resource we Americans are short on. Within newspapers, the opinion page is probably read the least. That's my guess. I hope I'm wrong. This doesn't mean that the page doesn't have fervent readers. It probably has more than any other section. So the readership is small, but passionate. The state of the opinion page in America today is as polarized as any other aspect of our schizophrenic life. Open the Wall Street Journal and you'll find a conservative viewpoint. In the New York Times, the op-ed page isn't the most liberal around, but it is surely among the most contentious. Since Donald Trump was elected, the quality of the pieces is somewhat lazy. I say this as an occasional contributor to them. The viewpoint is partisan. It is also predictable. Making a living out of dispensing opinion is heavy work. Columnists at times write twice a week. It sounds simple, 750 words times two. But those 1,500 words need to be well calibrated. They need to be provocative, unexpected, and insightful. It takes a particular type of character to keep up with the rhythm and not sound shallow. Democracy depends on the debate of ideas. They need to be pondered in public, openly, responsibly. Everything we do depends on what we think, and what we think results from the sharpening of our viewpoint. Columnists are essential actors in the democratic theater. They are teachers who make us think. We should be especially thankful when we disagree with them because they made us take a stand. The crucial element in the art of column writing is style. It isn't only about what we say, but about how we say it. Using words sparingly yet forcefully takes an entire career. I worry that the opinion page in our newspapers isn't about balance, but about ideological affiliation. I worry that in many cases it is written plainly, without personality. I worry that young readers aren't interested in them. I worry that we scream and shout at each other in the United States and that reading carefully constructed arguments is a dying trade. I worry that social media makes us all haiku fans. I worry that democracy is losing its moral fiber. Finally, I worry that we're forgetting how to think clearly. Ideas matter. Words matter. A vigorous marketplace of them makes us all stronger, regardless of political affiliation. Next time on In Contrast.
Every time we, the West, has had operations overseas, as we say, you know, that's a weird language, overseas, abroad, in another country, we have enabled a migration stream. The fact that the migration stream doesn't include all the poor and disadvantaged of that country is because the nexus is not there with all of them. It is with the people that they have used, often abused, etc., etc., who create a community of possibility. Huh?
Next time on In Contrast, Saskia Sassen. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our intern is Delina Hadgu. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.